What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, can the Liberals afford to water down net zero? And when it comes to ditching or keeping the target, is the opposition leader
damned if she does and damned if she doesn't?
You'll hear from a coalition frontbencher and get analysis from our political correspondent, Melissa Clark. Then, overseas, Israeli police arrest the country's most senior military lawyer. You'll find out the background to a story that's captured the country for months. Then we'll head to France and get the latest update from the investigation into the Louvre heist.
When we're dealing with art crime, in most cases, the assumption is organized crime groups. In this case, the crime was brazen, very clever, but a little bit sloppy.
And someone who can't afford to be sloppy.
The freedom of being out on the ocean, being side by side with nature, is certainly a pleasant way of spending 5 to 6 months.
You'll meet the man hoping to beat his father's sailing record, solo, circumnavigating the globe. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, there was plenty to cover with our lead guest on Radio National Breakfast this morning. Melissa McIntosh is the Shadow Communications Minister. So after yesterday's Senate inquiry into the Optus outage, Sally Sara had questions about the Coalition's response. But there's another issue plaguing the party, the Liberal Party. The pressure on Susan Lee and the Liberal Party to decide whether to follow the Nationals in formally ditching its commitment to achieving net zero emissions by 2050. The opposition leader has been facing internal tensions for months, and now there are questions over how she'll handle splitting views within the party. Today, the coalition will meet for its joint party room session. So before that, Shadow Communications Minister and Liberal frontbencher Melissa McIntosh joined Sally Sara.
Should the Liberal Party, in your view, adopt a slower approach to net zero, or should it follow the Nationals' policy position?
I think we'll come up with our own approach to where we're going to land. But I've been speaking to my community and surveying them, and they actually don't want us to be heading towards net zero by 2050. They're really suffering. Their energy prices are up. They want to do the right thing. They put solar panels on their roofs. They can't afford the batteries. And so my position is for us not to follow that track. We know that Labor is failing on their targets with net zero. We know they're failing on their targets with housing policy and their promise to build more housing, and they're failing Australians on the broken promises of bringing down power bills by $275. So we should be prosecuting being a strong opposition on those issues, and at the same time working out where we'll land on our energy policy.
Do you think there's enough goodwill in the Liberal Party for everyone to get behind a unified position?
I do, and I think the process that has been gone through, led by Dan Tehan, has been a good one. Everyone's had a chance to speak. It's not like we've waited for one party room, there's going to be an uproar and no one really knows each other's positions. People have had a chance to have meetings. We've heard from experts. We've come together and had those discussions. Dan's door's been open. So I think the fact that we've had so much time to have a real in-depth look, we've been able to represent our communities, which is what I'm doing, I think we'll land on a position. I just want our position to be a pragmatic position that works for everyday Australians, like the people in my community.
So whatever the position might be, does it have to be compatible with the Nats, or can it be, practically, can it be different from what the Nats' position is?
I think, and we've had such a long history of being able to work with the Nats. I sit next to David Littleproud in Question Time. I've got a strong relationship with many of them. I've worked with Anne Webster on the telco issue with 000. So I think we will. I think it's our relationship is strong enough for us to come to settle on a position, as long as we're listening to our communities. And I know speaking to people like Michael McCormack, that's what he's been doing, and his people are struggling as well with renewable projects out in the regions. So if we continue on a sensible path where we are stripping away any other agendas besides trying to do the best for Australians, I think we'll land there.
If we're looking at the leadership of Susan Lee, when it comes to net zero, is she damned if she does and damned if she doesn't?
I don't think so. I think the media, and I'm being honest with you here, I think the media are making more of that issue than what we're feeling internally. It's a difficult position. You can't say that coming to, you know, it has brought down previous leaders. It's not an easy issue for the coalition to deal with, and we have lost many seats across the country. So we are in a position of, we look at, okay, what do we do and how does that impact the communities and the seats that we would like to get back? But it has to also appeal to the seats that we retain, like mine in outer metro Sydney, in Western Sydney. So I don't think your comment there, I think it's a difficult position for her, but with the amount of consultation, I think we'll get them right.
Let's go to the Senate inquiry into the Optus 000 outage. What did you learn from yesterday's hearings, and what's the information that's still missing in your view?
I think we didn't hear enough from those hearings. The point of the hearings is that there were so many failures around Optus's handling of the outage, and we heard yesterday in the hearings there were 10 failures. And when I met with the CEO of Optus, he had indicated to me it was human error and it was a process issue, and that's not good enough. How can a human error result in an outage where people's lives were lost? And then the failings of even the government. So ACMA, I still believe that ACMA, and I feel this after even their appearance yesterday, should not be the investigator into the outage. They're part of the failed process. There's still question marks around when they knew and when they alerted the minister and all sorts of things like that. And it's not going to be a transparent outcome, I fear. We pushed really hard through Parliament to have a public register of outages so every single Australian can see what's going on. And the government's decided to push the onus back onto the telcos. And you think, well, which telcos are going to be really marking their own homework and publicising their problems? So it is complex, but at the end of the day, Australians need to have that assurance that they can get through when they make a 000 call. And I don't know that we're at that position yet. There's still many questions about what happened, and we need answers, and we need to know that it's not going to happen again.
You were just listening to Shadow Communications Minister and Liberal frontbencher Melissa McIntosh on Radio National Breakfast. I want to just double back for a moment to that discussion around net zero with Susan Lee. Our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, came on with Sally, and Sally asked the question that all of us are wondering.
Is it likely that the Liberal Party will dump net zero given what's happening?
Look, it is without doubt that the coalition's commitment as a whole to net zero is being watered down. The question is by how much? The shift that we have seen comes within the Liberal Party from both sides. We've seen the Conservatives within the Liberal Party who had been willing to entertain a compromise, now less willing to do so following the Nationals' move to dump net zero. The moderates are now reluctantly accepting that a compromise position is going to be necessary, but will not accept a complete dumping. So now the question is, well, what does that look like? If they retain some kind of adherence to the words net zero, does it become an aspiration rather than a target? Does it become by a different time frame? The questions that the Liberal Party now need to answer are, what is the long game when it comes to both policy and politics? And the policy question is a really important one here, because as you heard when you spoke to Melissa McIntosh, they're very focused on defining what they don't want. It's not clear at all what the Liberal Party is proposing that it will do. Melissa McIntosh talked about polling her electorate, saying this is about power prices. People want action, but they're suffering now. We need to focus on power prices and have a pragmatic approach. There is nothing from the Liberal Party to explain why a watering down of their commitment to net zero will lead to lower power prices. We have escalating power prices because coal-fired power stations are exiting the grid because there's no future investment in the private market for them, and the renewables that are being planned are not rolling out fast enough. This is where the problem is. So what are they proposing to do to address either of those issues? If they like to attack Labor's policies in this space, the safeguard mechanism, if you ease up on the safeguard mechanism, that might give some reprieve to big industrial electricity users, but that's not clear how that addresses the issue of getting electricity into the grid for retail customers. If they want to change the capacity investment scheme by letting coal and gas and nuclear in, well, at the moment, there's no appetite for private investment for coal or nuclear, so maybe you get an extra gas plant. Is that the policy? Do they take the Nationals' policy of reviving emissions reduction fund, which is straight taxpayer cash to polluters to reduce pollution? But again, it's not clear how that is going to reduce power prices. So the Liberal Party need to be able to define what they're doing as much as what they're not doing.
What does this mean for the leadership of Susan Lee? It was interesting, Melissa McIntosh is like, it's difficult.
Yeah. But also, it's not as bad as it seems. And look, I think there's some truth to that, in that it is without doubt that Susan Lee's grip on the leadership is tenuous. She's having her hand forced by the Conservatives. She will have to take heed of their desire in order to keep the party together. But in doing so, that alienates the moderates, who are the people that installed her in power. But firstly, there isn't one clear leadership challenger. And partly that is because they're not doing the numbers, because who wants to inherit the mess that she's dealing with now? I mean, for a leadership alternative aspirant to come forward now, let the person you want to defeat deal with the mess that you've got in front of you. It's not exactly an attractive prospect at this point. Add to that the blood that will be on the hands of the person who tears down the first female leader of the Liberal Party, especially so early into her leadership. It's not really something that those who have their eyes on the big prize, they don't really want either the optics of having done that or doing it before some of these really difficult issues have been sorted out.
It's like pass the parcel. You don't want it all landing in your lap.
Not at this point.
Mel Clark there. And of course, there'll be coverage of that story right across all ABC platforms today. Turning overseas to Israel, where police have arrested the military's former top lawyer over a leak to the press. It's been described as the most severe public relations attack on Israel since its establishment. Those words from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Last year, prosecutors raided an Israeli military detention centre. They detained 11 soldiers for interrogation over allegations that they'd severely, physically abused a Palestinian man in detention. Footage of the incident was sent to the media, and it was broadcast in August last year. Last week, a criminal investigation was launched into the leaking of the video. The military's top legal officer, Major General Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, was put on leave. Shortly after, she resigned her post and she took full responsibility for the leak. It's become a huge political issue in Israel. There are politicians deploring the criticism of the IDF and the investigation into its soldiers, and then there are some saying that this is stark evidence of malpractice within the military. Yesterday, reports emerged that this Major General had gone missing. There were widespread concerns for her safety. Her family even reportedly didn't know her whereabouts. But overnight, Israeli police confirmed that she had been found and then arrested. So we wanted to get a sense of just how significant this story was. Sally Cross to the Times of Israel legal affairs reporter, Jeremy Sharam.
It's massive because of the implications of the original scandal, the abuse scandal against the Palestinian detainee. So, you know, in particular, what's happened since these since the revelations have come, and since Tomer Yerushalmi admitted that she'd leaked the video, was that a lot of right-wing and far-right politicians began demanding that indictments against these five defendants be rescinded, saying that now they can't get a fair trial, and trying to claim that somehow the leak affair influences the indictment and the alleged offences themselves.
And the most recent development, so Yifat Toma Yerushalmi went missing as well in Tel Aviv.
That was last night here in Israel, and she was uncontactable for about an hour at least. And there was a big search by police, fire services and other rescue services trying to find her. Eventually, she was found, but she was also found without her phone. She also found was a what purported to be a suicide note, but police are now suspicious that her disappearance and the suicide note did not reflect a clear intention to commit suicide, but perhaps another attempt to obstruct justice, because she was found without her phone and she's now saying the phone's been lost. And obviously that phone was key to the investigators to find out other details of the leak and who might have been involved in the leak with her. And it's possible that that might add another obstruction of justice charge.
What does this story tell us about the push and pull between loyalty in Israel and the efforts of the military, but also accountability and shining a light when things have gone terribly wrong?
What we've seen with Toma Yerushalmi's conduct is actually reflective of a problem that's been evident in Israel for quite a while. When, in July 2024, there was actually originally 10 reservist soldiers were arrested for the abuse of this Palestinian detainee, we saw massive riots at the military detention centre where they were arrested. That included far-right politicians who broke into the military detention centre. And then when they found that the suspects were already not there, they went to another military camp, which is the site of the military court. And there was hundreds of activists, far-right activists, went to that camp, and dozens broke into the military courthouse as well. And we see this real antipathy amongst sections of the Israeli population to law enforcement, especially in this case where abuse of detainees in wartime could amount to a war crime. And yet the sentiment amongst, as I said, parts of the population, particularly the right and hard right, is that we cannot prosecute our own soldiers when we're fighting such a terrible war against such a brutal enemy. But that shows you the problems here which law enforcement and the legal system are facing when trying to prosecute this kind of issue.
And that is Jeremy Sharam there, the Times of Israel legal affairs reporter, speaking to Sally Sara about this case, the arrest of Israel's former top military lawyer. Well, until we get the Louvre Heist Daily podcast that I'm sure is in the works, you can expect to find the occasional update here, because it's quite the fascinating investigation. Prosecutors in Paris say that the daring jewellery heist was carried out not by organised professionals, but instead by petty criminals. They still haven't found the jewels, but they've made a number of arrests that Sally spoke to art crime specialist Noah Chani about.
There were two suspects in their 30s arrested. One was on his way for a flight abroad at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The other was arrested in a northern suburb of Paris. And there was a third suspect and a fourth, a 37-year-old man, a 38-year-old woman, who were charged. The man had 11 prior convictions, and all of them had trace DNA found on some of the objects left behind at the scene of the crime. Now, when we're dealing with art crime, in most cases, the assumption is organized crime groups, whether they're small or large or syndicates, are behind it. In this case, the crime was brazen, very clever, but a little bit sloppy. And of course, police will know the connections that the four people arrested had, and therefore be aware of whether they were linked to organized crime groups or maybe acting on their own.
What's your thinking about how saleable the jewels might be?
Well, here's the thing. I've done a lot of interviews on this, and I never want to give criminals any ideas, but if they're smart at all, what they would have done is within hours of the theft, they would have broken up the jewelry, had the gems recut so that they were not immediately recognizable, and then they can be sold even on the open market for as much as 10% of the value of the jewels intact. Now, all the jewels, 8 of them intact, might have been worth upwards of 80, 90 million, but if you're talking about the intrinsic value of the raw materials, which is very important here, it's distinctive from stealing a painting, for example, which has no intrinsic value because it's just composed of canvas and wood and pigment. These jewels are incredibly valuable. They might fetch 8 to 10 million on the open market, and they can be sold on the open market if they're not immediately recognizable as what was stolen. And so that's the real danger, is that they're already broken up.
How much cooperation is there internationally between police, and will they be able to tell, even if these jewels have been recut, will they be able to tell that there's something unusual on the market?
It's, you know, you can put out a sort of all points bulletin to keep your eyes open for jewels, gems matching the descriptions of what was taken in case they were recut, but that's very difficult to do.
And what do we know from previous cases about how patient these thieves are, or whether some of them grow impatient within the gang and want to start selling sooner than they probably should?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. If, in fact, they're not related to an organized crime group, then it's a group of individuals who saw this as an opportunity. They probably had some inside information. One of the pieces of inside information we know that they had is that there is a special handbook that's available for internal firefighters who work at the Louvre that explains how you can use an angle grinder to easily pop open these highly protected cases in case you need to extract the jewelry if there's a fire. Now, it's available online. Unfortunately, you can find this out. So it doesn't mean that they had an insider, but they were sophisticated enough to do that. But if it's an organized crime group, then they will have a destination already in mind for the gems, and the gems will already be distributed. They may not be sold yet, but they will be far from Paris by now.
Noah Chani there, an art crime specialist and a professor of art history in Slovenia. 179 days, 21 hours, 37 minutes and 58 seconds. That is how long it took Tasmanian man Ken Gourlay to circumnavigate the world solo on a sailboat. Now, almost 20 years later, his son, Tristan, wants to beat his Australian record. It's quite the story. So before he launches off from Hobart this week, he dialed into Sally.
Why has this journey appealed to you for so long, and now you want to get out there and give it a go?
It's just the freedom of being out on the ocean, being side by side with nature. It's just certainly a pleasant way of spending 5 to 6 months. The plan is to leave out of Hobart, shoot down underneath New Zealand, and then through underneath Cape Horn, then coming up the east coast of South America, up the Atlantic to cross the equator, and then back down under South Africa and home back to Hobart.
And the tech and communications, they must have changed quite a bit from almost 20-odd years ago.
Yes, I have. Dad was using a laptop and a sat phone when things were very, very slow back then. I think he said it took him about 12 minutes to upload a photo. But moving with the times now, I've got the Starlink on board, so now I can throw videos and photos up onto Facebook within seconds. So and it'll be a lot better for the weather as well. I'll be able to use a lot more different weather apps.
Tristan, what does your dad think about this mission to see if you can go a bit quicker around the globe?
I think he's pretty excited. he's certainly been enthusiastic with helping with the boat preparations and everything, and giving me little bits of advice along the way as we've been working on the boat. I think he's pretty happy, and I think he'd sort of rather see the record stay in the family.
And what sort of importance was there for sailing for the father-son relationship when you were growing up? Because it's quite a nice thing for dads and kids to do together.
Yes, it has been great. Dad was, he was always there. He was one that pushed me out in a little sabo, nearly 40 years ago. And then since then, we've done quite a fair bit together. We've done a few Melbourne to Devonport. We've done the Sydney to Hobart, and just recently the Melbourne to Osaka. And I certainly do enjoy it. It is really good quality father-son time.
Tristan Gourlay there, who's about to set off and try and break his father's record, solo circumnavigating the world in a sailboat. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap. As always, you can listen to the radio show live at 5:30 every morning on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. And then sometime after that, The Breakfast Wrap will be in your feed on the Listen app or also on Radio National. Every interview was presented by Sally Sarah, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Michael Commode. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears, same time, same place.